Go from the sea. Recording started. It's amazing.
I'm on my favorite show.
You're on your favorite show? Look, I wore my favorite show shirt.
No way.
I did.
Cryptid Campfire.
Yeah, you may have heard of it.
Yeah, I know.
Let me do the intro, and then there's something that I want to bring up that happened yesterday that I feel like is important to bring up.
Is it like
that I didn't know? It's not behind the scenes. It's you. It's about a show I didn't know that you were on. You just showed up on my TV yesterday.
Is this on Tubi?
Yeah.
Anyways.
All right. Here we go. Hello, welcome to The Lore You Know, a show where we chat with some amazing human beings who are storytellers, collectors, and folklorists as we discuss the history of, inspiration behind, and importance of recording and sharing regional tales. Today, I have with me director extraordinaire Eli Watson.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks. I'm so glad that you finally made it. I've been trying to get you on here for years.
It has actually been years. You know, I've always been very supportive of the show. I've been an avid listener since episode one.
Yeah.
And now it's one of my favorite shows, and now I'm here.
You made it, Eli.
Yep.
Full circle.
It's crazy. My life is full of concentric full circles.
Yeah. Speaking of full circles, yesterday, working on some stuff, some projects that we haven't actually announced yet, but I was working on some projects and I decided to turn on Tubi, and there was this show about like monsters in America or something. I think that's what it was called. And
various monsters.
Yeah. All of a sudden, bam, Eli Watson's on the screen.
Yep. It happened.
When did that even come out? I feel like I was led astray not knowing about this. When did this happen?
Well, I recorded that back in, I want to say, like, summer of 2021.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it was summer 2021 because I have a fresh haircut in it. So, and so it was like, I had just started working with Small Town Monsters at that point, but yeah. I wasn't like an employee yet. So, you know, any and all cryptid documentaries were on the table for me.
Right.
So this company reached out to me because they were looking for young people to talk about cryptids. And I was like, oh, you're in the wrong community. But sure. And they found out through Cryptid Campfire. They found out about me through Cryptid Campfire. So they actually reached out to all of us, but the other two said they didn't want to do it. And I was like, but they're offering you money to just... Anyways, but... So I did it, and then they were like, yeah, we don't know when this is going to come out. And then sometime last year, I just started getting texts from a bunch of people that were like, hey, you're on this Tubi documentary. Like, and when I went in to do my interview, they didn't even have a title for it. So, like, I don't even know what the title is, really.
Yeah.
I think it's Scariest Monsters in America, but...
Yeah, something like that. I don't even know the title for it, and I just watched it yesterday. But it is something about monsters in America.
Yep, and I'm talking about Chupacabra.
You were talking about Chupacabra. So I was like, oh, Eli's favorite cryptid.
It used to be. Before I found out it's not real.
Oh, man.
Hot take, everyone. Hot take.
Oh, no. Now you're going to set Twitter all ablaze. Or X all ablaze.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, now that we got through that tangent, how about you explain the origin story of Eli Watson and how you got into the cryptid community, sir?
Well, you know, when two people love
each other. I knew that that's where you're going to start.
You know me too well. No, I, so it started, as far as cryptids go, I was like never super into them as a kid. Mm-hmm. Like I grew up watching Monster Quest, and also I like grew up with the internet. Like I was right at the right. age where the internet was new when I was a little kid. My parents spent like $1,000 on a computer that sucked. with like dial up internet, and they're like, this is the greatest thing of all time, you know.
Yeah.
And it was on, so I also like saw a lot of Chupacabra blogs. YouTube was full in the early days, was full of videos like top 10 unexplained photos, you know, and they're like 240p with creepy music made in Windows Movie Maker, and that stuff had a lasting effect on me. And I was always going in and out of these waves of like being super interested in it and then being like, I don't care, I'm gonna go play with action figures now. And it was like 2018, I was going to film school in LA. I was working at a movie theater in LA, and I was going through a phase where I was really into Mothman, and I was really into the Patterson Gimlin film. And I was talking to a buddy of mine named Alex, a different Alex, not Alex Petikov, but Alex Dai Kaiju, who ended up being my co-host. And so I was like, we were talking about Bigfoot and talking about the Patterson Gimlin film. And I was like, oh, dude, we should start a podcast. And I remember I said that to him. I said, dude, we should start a podcast. And he goes, ha. And then he walked away. And I was like, oh, I was like, actually serious, but okay. And then he came back a few days later and was like, hey, you know, I was thinking about what you said. You know, I think we should start a podcast. And I was like, yes, let's go. And so we both agreed, though, you know, two dudes talking about Bigfoot and getting really into the nitty gritty and the details and stuff, it isn't exactly like interesting content.
Yeah.
So we're like, we need a third person, preferably someone who doesn't know that much about it, but has an interest in it. Right. And so that's when I thought of Jasmine, my other co-host. And I was like, Jasmine, do you believe in Bigfoot? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, are you into like cryptids and stuff? She was like, well, more ghosts. And I was like, oh, cool. And that's how that trio formed. And we made Cryptid Campfire. So that started late 2018. And then I just kind of fell down the rabbit hole from there. And that's when I read my first cryptozoology book, which was Bigfoot, The True Story of Apes in America by Lauren Coleman. That was the first one I ever read. And then I got really into like collecting like rare first editions. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, I have quite a few, like John Green, Bernard Hoovelman's, Ivan Sanderson stuff. Oh man, my collection's pimp. But but yeah, that's where that all started. And then in 2020, I interviewed Nash Hoover from Chasing Legends on the show on Cryptid Campfire. And then through him and Alex Petikov, who was working with Nash at the time, we both started doing Chasing Legends, or all three of us did Chasing Legends together in 2020. Mm-hmm. Also in 2020, I interviewed Seth Breedlove. You might have heard of him.
Yeah, I've heard of him.
Yeah. Of Small Town Monsters.
Yeah, right. That's yeah. it. That's where that's I've heard the name.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
Interviewed him on the show, and we had a good conversation, and then he invited me out for what would be the On the Trail of Bigfoot, the Discovery shoot.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. And so that was like, I did that trip in April of 2021. And so I did the Discovery and the tie-in Beyond the Trail in the same trip. And then that's when Seth said, oh, you should take, he was talking to Alex and said, you should take Eli with you on your trips. And I was all for it. So that's how I started doing Beyond the Trail. And now I'm doing Mysteries and Monsters and this soon to be upcoming series.
Right. Can't say too much about it.
Well, it's going to come out at the end of the month.
Oh, well then this will come out actually in a couple weeks. So, I mean, it might be safe to talk about it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it comes out publicly December 3rd. So,
okay. Well, let's see. This will come out on the 27th of November.
Oh, well, then that's perfect to just kind of promote it, I guess.
Let's talk about it then. Okay. What is coming up?
It's called The Road to Discovery, an Eli Watson production. No, it's just called The Road to Discovery. I think the full title is Bigfoot, The Road to Discovery, it was an idea I had earlier this year to where I really wanted to recreate. I wanted to capture the essence of the, like the 70s and the 80s Sasquatch documentaries. So, okay. You know, like the Robert Morgan stuff, you know, Sasquatch Odyssey, Ivan Marx. No, I was going to say Karl Marx, but Ivan Marx.
Nope.
Yeah. The Marx different genre. Brother, you know.
Yeah.
Anyways, I wanted to capture that vibe because I think it's such a unique, it's almost its own genre of documentary, because even other documentaries from the 70s and 80s weren't like the Bigfoot documentaries of that era. Yeah. So, and, you know, all of them were filmed in the PNW, and I like the Pacific Northwest, and I wanted to go out there and just do that same thing, but with the Olympic Project.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of where that idea stemmed from. And so it's a 6-episode miniseries at the moment with potential for more episodes down the line. And the other thing I really wanted to do with it too is I wanted to boil down to the reason why anyone would even look for Bigfoot in the first place. Because it's a pretty, with it being so like, widely accepted that it's not real, that it's just a folklore thing, but there's like actual evidence that there's an animal out there, and it's like, why would anyone even go looking for it? And what are they looking to find besides Bigfoot? Is there like a greater reason they feel that they should be looking for it or not? And I feel like that's something, at least in the documentaries I've produced for Small Town Monsters, has not been touched on. So
Did you have any type of personal revelations as you were going through the edit, or maybe while you were out in the field?
Yeah, definitely out in the field. I don't know, because the whole Bigfoot community has exploded and it's gotten so big as opposed to those early days.
Right.
It's there's a million different opinions about it, and for me, it boils down to, it's like, well, who's collecting the data? Who's, and not just the stories as well. Stories are valuable, but it's like, what can we glean from the stories? What kind of behaviors and patterns in behavior? Because that's ultimately, at the end of the day, what's going to help you find this thing is predictable behaviors. And that's been the problem so far, is these things don't act with any amount of predictability, so you can never guess where they're going to be. And so how do we tackle that problem? And you know, the people in the Olympic Project, like Chris Spencer and Shane Corson, they're doing interesting work and in trying to gather that kind of data, and it's not glorious work. It's the true definition of research. It's like lots of data crunching, lots of number crunching, but they're also out in the field collecting that data too. And I think that's what's important. And so it's like, I don't know, it kind of like just shaped up. It's like, yeah, the discovery of this thing could be possible. But the problem is there's not enough people doing stuff that's actually going to discover it. So, because you're not, I just feel like you're not going to discover Bigfoot going out on the weekends. You're not going to do it.
Right. So the group that's up in the PNW is putting in the legwork for this then. Are there other groups in the US that you're aware of that are doing that kind of research?
I think the NAWAC probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's just those two though.
Just those two.
I think maybe the BFRO, maybe in the early days.
Yeah.
The BFRO now is I know Matt. I know Matt Moneymaker. I've worked with mm-hmm. Matt. I like Matt.
Yeah.
And I just think the whole organization as a whole, BFRO, it's gotten really, really big. And there's mm-hmm. a lot of Moneymaker can't be everywhere all the time.
Right.
And that's the problem, is the people who are in charge of their certain sectors, I think, don't necessarily have the best interest in mind for mm-hmm. Sasquatch research, I guess, for the actual goal of the organization. So
right.
That's why I wouldn't say the BFRO. But.
Gotcha. So then based on where the researchers are that are like putting in the data crunching and doing all of that, and where we have reports, would you think, like, where do you think we're most likely to have a discovery occur? Would it be the Pacific Northwest? Because that's where, or is that too dense?
I don't know. It would either be the Pacific Northwest or like Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not saying that I think that's just where Bigfoot is, because I think Bigfoot's all over the country. Right. Anywhere you have viable habitat is probably where they're going to be. But the problem is that's not where the researchers are. It's like right. Maine is super viable habitat, but there's no researchers in Maine. So, right. you know, if a Bigfoot dies in Maine, no one's ever going to find it.
right.
So,
I gotcha.
Yeah, but I mean, that's the other problem too, is how dense the woods are, especially in the Pacific Northwest. I don't think people think of the Pacific Northwest and they think of like Portland and Seattle, and it's like, but there's so much more out there.
Yeah.
And it's so thick, and it's they call it a temperate rainforest, and that's what it is. It's a rainforest. There's undergrowth, overgrowth, in between growth, and it's everywhere, and it gets everywhere, and you're just like, dang, this is rough. And then the weather is also extremely volatile, and it rains a lot up there too, and so people are less likely to be outside when it's raining. People are less likely to go camping when it's raining.
Right.
So there's lots of potential out there in the Pacific Northwest, but it's hard for me to say if that's where they're going to get discovered.
Mm-hmm. Talking about camping and different types of weather, what's the most extreme situation that you've been in? Because you've been out in the field with Alex, you've been out in the field without Alex, but you've been out there during all types of weather. So like, what is the worst scenario that you've had to deal with?
I think the worst scenario was probably, excuse me, it was in Colorado is what I want to say. It was Colorado. And we drove up into the mountains to try to find a camp spot, and we were on these dirt roads, and then it started to rain. And like, as you know, we were in a valley, and then you go up in the mountains, and then the mountains, they will change weather unexpectedly. So I don't blame anyone for this scenario, because it could have happened. Right. But we were on top of the mountain when the rainstorm hit, and all the roads were muddy, and we were like, well, we're not getting down,
right?
Because we might slide off the mountain. And it was like we were in the thunderstorm, and we were like seeing the lightning explode around us, and we tried to get some stuff from the back of the car, but the wind was so extreme, it like ripped the tent out, and we were like trying to shove the tent back into the car. And so we decided we were just going to have to sleep in the front seats. And there was so much stuff in the car that we couldn't recline the seats. And I couldn't reach any of my coats, and I couldn't get any extra blankets or anything. And I was so cold. I ended up sleeping, curling up in a ball and sleeping in the footwell of the passenger side while it was raining and the wind was blowing the car and lightning was going all around us. It was insane. And then when we woke up in the morning, it was the most beautiful, sunny, clear day. It was mind blowing. I was like, what is going on? Yeah.
Wow. I was thinking that you were going to say it turned into a huge blizzard at some point.
No, that would have been worse, but no, fortunately we haven't been stuck in anything like that. So
that's good. That's good. Oh man. So of all the places that you've traveled that you haven't returned to, because obviously you've returned to the Pacific Northwest more than once, correct?
Yeah.
What is one place that you've been to that you haven't been able to get back to yet, but you would really like to?
Oh, Colorado, for sure. Yeah.
Why is that?
Oh, it's just really pretty out there. And yeah. I like the mountains. And the reports from out there, like, kind of blow my mind. I don't know what to make of it because I'm pretty, like, set with my opinions until I get new information, right? Obviously, that's how that works. But
right,
I've been thinking about this a lot lately because people have no way of accurately guesstimating how tall something is. They've done scientific studies on this, and we are terrible at how tall is that tree? I don't know, 20 feet. And then it's like, oh, it's only 10. You know, it's like,
right, right.
So I'm always pretty. And for me, like in Cliff's Museum, the North American Bigfoot Center, he's got a life-size Sasquatch on display. And they asked me how tall it was. And I was like, oh, it's got to be like 9 feet. And they're like, it's only 7. And I was like, oh, that's 7 feet is bigger than I thought, you know?
Right, right.
And so I'm always, whenever I hear reports of like Sasquatch that's 9 or 10 feet tall, I'm like, okay, maybe they're 8 feet tall. And right, people just, because the other thing is too, they're tall and they're wide, so it's mm-hmm. like they're just really big.
Yeah.
But the reports in Colorado, we were investigating this couple that had seen them on multiple occasions, and what they were describing was they were seeing eyeshine 13 feet off the ground, and these creatures being able to step cleanly over their 4 foot tall fences. And it's like, even if you were 7 feet tall, I don't know if you would be able to step over a fence like that with ease.
Right.
So I don't know what to make of that. What do you make of that?
I don't have anything to make of that. I've got nothing.
I don't know.
I know that when we were in Alaska, we measured at the one Airbnb that was like it was separated where the main floor and then a loft, and we were measuring how tall the loft was, which was like 12 feet up or something. And then just thinking about those reports, the high end of, you know, the 12 foot tall Sasquatch, like that would be unreal. It doesn't sound, I mean, it sounds like a lot, but not really whenever you're thinking about it. But when it's measured like that, that would be quite a creature.
It almost feels like it's too big.
Yeah. Right.
Like it's not possible for it to be that big.
Right. Right. Oh man. So that was in Colorado. Are there other places that you'd like to go back to that you haven't yet? You mentioned Maine earlier, but I don't know how many times you've been to Maine.
I've only been to Maine once.
Is that worth, I don't want to say it that way. Would you want to go back to Maine?
I would like to go back to Maine because I want to go back to Lauren Coleman's museum.
There it is.
Because I was only there, I was only at his museum for like half an hour tops.
Did you get him to sign stuff? Do you have his signature on your first edition book?
No.
Eli.
I have his signature. A couple years ago, before I started traveling the country, he did a sale for the museum, and he was selling signed books. So I bought a couple online that have his signature on them. And then once I saw him in Maine in 2021, and then I saw him again in 2022 in Lakeland, Florida, and he published this book on mermaids that I wanted to buy.
Right.
And then I said, I'm going to come back around and I'm going to buy that book and I want you to sign it. And he said, okay, I'll be here. And then I left and I came back and he was gone.
Oh, so, no.
That was the last time I saw Lauren. So I got to get back up to Maine to be like, yo, let me buy this mermaid book. And I want you to sign it.
When you first met Lauren, or anyone that you've got, you know, that you have their books on, have you ever had an instance where you were like starstruck in a way upon meeting them the first time? Or were you totally chill when you met Lauren Coleman? Like, yeah, hey, best friend.
I was pretty chill when I met Lauren. I think Lyle Blackburn, I still get starstruck around Lyle.
Yeah.
Shannon LeGros, one of my icons.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to think. Probably Ken Gerhard. I forget that I've met him. Because I met him briefly once, and I was like, what do I even say to this guy? And that usually doesn't happen to me, but I think because I got into the field in 2018, and I like didn't know who anyone was. Like, if you would have asked me as a kid, who's Lauren Coleman, I would have been like, I don't know.
Right.
You know? I got into it so recently, and then I started meeting everyone so quickly afterwards. I've met a lot of people first and then realized who they were after the fact.
Right.
So it's like a lot of the times I'll go into a room, be introduced to a bunch of people. I don't know who anyone is. So I'm just like, hey, what's up? And then afterwards it's like, oh, this is Steve Coles, the guy who like debunked this, or, you know, oh, really? I didn't know that.
Right. So then on the flip side, have there been times where afterwards you're like, oh man, I should have gone about that a different way, or no, a little bit of embarrassment?
Like, oh, I wish I would have gotten a book signed, or I wish I would have like asked him, or like, oh, now I have like a really good question about this that they could probably answer. So,
right.
But usually I just reach out and be like, hey, do you remember me? And they're like, yes. I'm like, here's a question
for you. So going back a little bit, you mentioned this Chasing Legends. Can you talk about that a little bit, what that was, and where all you went?
Well, Chasing Legends is a series produced by Nash Hoover of Minnesota, and what's on your cup, Heather?
What's David Bowie, David from The Labyrinth?
I thought it was Lord of the Rings.
No, I don't have a Lord of the Rings cup. I wish I did.
All right. Well, Christmas.
Yes.
Chasing Legends. So Nash Hoover is an investigator, researcher who like travels the country looking for cryptids. Mm-hmm. And so he did this Kickstarter in 2020, which I backed, and then I helped produce and edit the four episodes that formed that season of Chasing Legends. And so the first one they did without me, which took place in Boston, they were looking for the Pukwudgies.
Okay.
And then they did the Mogollon Monster in Arizona, which is like a Bigfoot creature on the Mogollon Rim. And then they did Champ at Lake Champlain in Vermont. And then they did the Rougarou in Louisiana. Mm. Yeah. So all of that was really fun to produce. All of those are available on the Chasing Legends YouTube channel, by the way.
Okay.
And then, as far as I know, Nash is looking to produce a couple more episodes here in the new year. So
nice, nice. So you had that, and then you ended up in Beyond the Trail with Alexander.
Yeah.
And then you had Mysteries and Monsters.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about the idea behind Mysteries and Monsters? No. Just like, no.
No. Yeah, Mysteries and Monsters. I wanted to do a series that was basically like Monster Quest with the flavor of In Search Of. And I wanted it to be a different topic every episode. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be kind of adventurous. I think the main thing, what I've said on other shows before, is I wanted it to feel like you were learning about the subject with me. Okay. So, and I think the first few episodes really capture that. And even the last episode that came out, The Werewolves of the North Woods, I think really feel like, hey, I'm Eli Watson. I don't know much about this, but I'm going to learn this. And I want you to come along with me, because I think that makes, then it's like a story. You have a main character who you're anchored with, you know, right. And me being so transparent about, like, I'm learning this on all as I go, is I think it helps the viewer as well. Like, okay, I can relate to this dude because I don't know anything about this. And then you're discovering it with me. And I think it makes it really fun. So it was like a really upbeat, punchy show is what I wanted it to be. And I think I've achieved that for the most part. So,
yeah. Thinking about the different, because that was completely your show. I mean, you came up with the idea, you produced it, you edited it, everything was Eli.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference? This is more of a technical question. What's the difference between doing something like a YouTube series and then something like Chupacabra? I mean, those are two different animals, right? Does it mm-hmm. feel like that?
Yeah. Well, Chupacabra was unique because I guess I directed it, but
yeah,
it was unique. I don't know. That's a tough one. Because with Mysteries and Monsters, I had such a clear vision of what I wanted the show to be in the beginning.
Right.
And the hardest one, well, there was quite a few difficult ones to put together. But like, it was finding the style in the first episode and then kind of creating, like, that's the template to work with.
Mm-hmm.
But what's challenging about it is the very nature of the show, how I want it to be a different topic every episode. And that takes a lot of research, and it takes a lot out of me to create the scripts for those shows.
Right.
But I still, I greatly enjoy the process of it.
Mm-hmm.
As far as Chupacabra, it was like I had the interviews there, and it was a matter of finding the story within the interviews.
Gotcha.
And without a main character, a main anchor, I guess, if you will, I would say that's probably what's missing from Chupacabra, is if I had to say something was missing from it. And don't get me wrong, I'm proud of what Chupacabra is
mm-hmm.
as it turned out. But I still wish there would have been a character that we would have followed throughout it.
Right.
Because there's so many twists and turns and different rabbit holes in the story of the Chupacabra. So it's like, I don't want to say it's a surface level overview, because they get into it. They get into it. But right. It's like, I just wish there was something to really just punch home
mm-hmm.
the really interesting stuff. Yeah, and what I find interesting is not what everyone else finds interesting too.
Right. So, right. Is it difficult to find that balance? as a director and editor, figure out what,
Yeah, because I have to hold back a lot. And because I get really interested in like the minutiae of stuff, the little details. And it's like, because that's the saying, right? The devil's in the details. Mm-hmm. You can, by analyzing, like, for example, the George Adamski documentaries I put together for Mysteries and Monsters.
Yeah.
There's a very detailed account in Adamski's first book about the exact time stuff occurred in and the actions that he performed in that exact amount of time. And when you really start to think about it, the exact make and model of the cameras given, and you know, he's talking about how many pictures he took in 30 seconds time. He's saying he took like 10 photos. But you have to remember, this isn't modern day where you're snapping shots on your iPhone. This is the 1950s. Not only that, he's shooting on glass plates that you have to swap out every single time you take a photo. And then you start to realize, oh, this isn't really adding up.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, that's interesting. And that's that kind of stuff is like, it's interesting, and especially the way I just explained it now, but it's like certain things like that I come across and I go down these rabbit holes and I'm like, okay, so this is why this doesn't make sense. Or sometimes it works the opposite way and it corroborates and you're like, oh, of course, that's the detail that would make sense. That's the detail that corroborates what's going on. And but I don't know if I'm watching a documentary, I don't necessarily want to be bombarded with all those details,
right?
You know, it's like that's what books are for, so maybe I should just write a book.
Yeah, when are you gonna do that? I happen to know a company that's publishing books.
What am I gonna write a book about?
I don't know, Eli, this is on you, you're the author.
I'm going to write a book about me.
Okay.
And every lie I've ever told in my life.
Do you want to air out some of those right now?
No.
I don't blame you. Oh my goodness.
No, I don't blame you.
So when you were going through Mysteries and Monsters and you're finding out all these details on things, and you're going through the minutiae and some things are clicking or some things are clicking, but in a different way that changes the narrative a little bit. Was there anything like of all of those episodes that you did, is there anything that really stuck with you that kind of changed your opinion on things, on what you'd previously believed or thought?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I would say it changed my opinion, but I think the perfect example of that was the last episode, Werewolves of the North Woods, mm-hmm. where I'm talking about the whole Dogman phenomena. And I've stated it multiple times what I think that is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's, you know, paranormal shape-shifting is what I think the phenomena can be explained down to. And mm-hmm. so, but I had nothing really to kind of support that. But as I dug into the stories, and what I discovered is shape-shifting is an umbrella term, and it's all the stories are thrown in together. And I explain it a lot in the episode, but you know, you talk about the story of Lycan, who was transformed into a wolf. That's a shape-shifting story. But mm-hmm. so is the Navajo skinwalker.
Right.
That's shape-shifting. But it's like the difference between those two is one was an allegorical story talking about the dangers of cannibalism, and the other one is a reportedly real phenomenon. So mm-hmm. is it fair to label those both as shape-shifting stories? Because I think that connotates like a different meaning to that. So it was interesting to me to find that, you know, people bring up Navajo skinwalkers as like the primary kind of shape-shifting thing, but it's like other cultures have very similar traditions. mm-hmm. but they're not called skinwalker, you know, in what are they called? In Morocco, they're called the Buddha or the werehyenas, where shamans will use black magic to transform. And it's like, well, that sounds a lot like a skinwalker, you right. know? And there's one in Australia, there's one in England, and it's like, so that you have these legends, and that to me was like, oh, okay, so I might be right, you know, because like,
right,
I don't think it's a popular thing, you know, mm-hmm. and certainly in these traditions and these cultures, it's not like the first thing that they would tell you about. It's not like if you met a Navajo person and you said, oh, tell me about your culture, the first thing they're going to bring up is skinwalkers. No,
right.
Not. You know, so yeah. it's like they're all really niche. And I wouldn't even say niche, but they're taboo. Even in their culture, they don't like to talk yeah. about those things, for the same reason Navajo don't like to talk about skinwalkers. You know, right. it brings that bad energy. It invites it. So it's mm-hmm. like these things are happening. People are talking about them happening. And like, physically, like in flesh and blood, and not as a mythological statement. It's right. like a real thing, but they don't like to talk about it. And it's yeah. like, well, to me, that makes sense, because I don't know necessarily if I would want to talk about that either, you know, sure. if my brother was doing something like that, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, that, and then the other thing that was stumping me a lot, I don't talk about this point in the episode because it would have been too much information to bring up all at once, but mm-hmm. there's the story in Dogman Triangle, the movie with James Witter. They interview Aaron and Shannon interview James Witter, mm-hmm. who witnessed the Plum Creek Monster. Mm-hmm. And only his main story made it into the cut, but there's several other smaller stories that didn't make the cut because they just didn't have the dramatic tension. But he reports seeing multiple of these creatures at the same time. And so like he has the one where he chased him on a horse, but he has this one where he saw them like walk out of the bushes from this creek and then walk mm-hmm. into the woods, just like walk. He didn't chase them or anything. And the I believe what he said was that he thought that they were related, like, you know, either through parents, like one was a parent, one was the child, or they were brother and sister. I can't remember exactly. And that stumped me because I was like, because my theory postulates that they're shapeshifters and you wouldn't necessarily expect a family of shapeshifters. Well, right. what I discovered looking in the details was a book about werewolves by Montague Summers, written in 1933, in which they talk about an Irish tradition of werewolves. And mm-hmm. the term werewolfism is used as a hereditary trait. So you could have a whole mm-hmm. family of werewolves, people who transform at night. And I'm like, wow. That's awesome. So maybe, I don't know, there could be something there. I don't know.
Right. Maybe it was a family unit.
Could have been. And I was like, I would have never even thought, but apparently there it is, almost 100 years old.
That's so cool. And yeah. what book is that?
That's, I think it's just called Werewolves, but okay. it's by Montague Summers. So Montague.
Gotcha.
Summers. Yeah.
Cool. Well, you were talking about, you know, if you speak with someone from the Navajo Nation, the first thing that they may speak of is not skinwalkers because it's, yeah. You know, taboo. Have you, in all of your travels and interviews with different people, have there been any instances where it's been more difficult to get a story out of someone because of how taboo the topic is? Like, have you noticed that in certain areas that it's a little more difficult to glean those details from people?
I haven't felt that way.
Yeah.
No, I haven't felt that way. I don't think. No.
That's good. That makes it yeah. harder.
I've been very fortunate. So, yeah. So yeah, no, I've had difficult witnesses for different reasons, but not for not talking about what they want to talk about. So
right. No, I get that. I understand that for sure. Well, Eli, we are at the end of the show, but what I always ask of my guests is to tell me a story before we leave. So Eli, do you have a story that you could tell me, whether it's a story about your favorite cryptid or maybe a personal story that while you were out in the field that just is entertaining? Do you have a story?
My whole life is a story.
Okay. Well, let's settle in then.
I don't know. What is a story, a good story?
Well,
that's so open-ended. I don't know.
It is open-ended. That's the point, to try to stump you. But what about the different places that you've traveled, some of the local legends that you've heard that maybe have stuck with you that are different, they're unique, whether they're cryptids or creatures?
I've heard this story, and I'm not going to share who told me this story.
Okay.
But it is about the Bluff Creek area.
Okay.
Because when Alex and I went to Bluff Creek, and for context, that's where the Patterson-Gimlin film was shot back in 1967. Excuse me. I believe we had Sasquatch activity there, but I remember also we saw an orb just flying in the sky, and that kind of... So the story behind that, this is not the story I want to tell, but basically we went to this area that overlooked a valley. And so if you imagine the kind of... We were on like a finger, if you imagine it that way, that overlooked this huge valley. And it was nighttime, and we saw this light. And at first we thought it was a star, but noticed it was kind of like moving in this weird way. And it was moving west to east, and it was bouncing up and down like a ball, but in the sky, but not in the stars, like it was floating above the valley. And we didn't have any weird feelings from it. It was like this orangey, whitish, glowing ball of light. And it happened to disappear as the sun came up. It disappeared into the light of the sun, and I never saw it. But this thing was floating there, moving slowly for like 10 minutes.
Wow.
It's just like there, floating around. And apparently that's a thing in the Bluff Creek area, and multiple people I have talked to have seen the orbs. And the person who told me this story said that they were there at Louse Camp, which is like the Sasquatch camp there at Bluff Creek. And other people use it too, but like, it's so far out of your way. Casual campers don't really go there. So, and plus, once you're in Louse Camp, you don't have cell service. So like, if something happens, you're kind of screwed. Right. So Louse Camp, I actually think, was started by Tom Slick back in the day, if I'm not mistaken. But so we were talking about the orbs and stuff, and they told me that they were there. It was him and one other person, and then this truck pulled into the camp, and it was this Native American Yurok dude, and he had a name in the story, and I guess he was such a character, he could remember the dude's name, and I've forgotten the name at this point. But apparently he pulls into camp and he goes, "Hey, do you guys have any coffee?" And they were like, "No, but we can make you some." So he's like, "Cool." So he sits down with them, and they start cooking coffee, and the dude starts talking, you know, about how he's connected to nature, and they think, "Oh yeah, whatever, this dude's just full of it." And then he's like, "No, look up at the look, there's a bird up there. He's my friend. And then he like whistled at him in like bird language, and it came over and landed on his shoulder.
Wow.
And then they were like, oh, well, the coffee's ready. Do you want coffee? And he's like, no, I never drink coffee.
What?
And they saw a deer. They like saw a deer too, like on the outskirts of camp. And he just kind of like started talking to the deer, and the deer came into camp and like laid down there.
Wow. And
the dude talked to him for a few hours, and the animals left. And then he was like, all right, I'm out of here, and got back in his truck and left. But he had told them that the Sasquatch in that area travel by turning into balls of light. And that's what those orbs are.
Oh, wow.
And that's like the one thing that gives me pause. I'm like, what do you make of that? And let me be clear. I'm not sharing who this person is, because I don't know if they would want me sharing this story necessarily right. Publicly attributed to them.
Right.
Because it is a very reliable source. I was pretty mind blown. I was like, I can't believe what you're telling me right now.
Right.
So, but I mean, and here's the other thing about Bluff Creek too. I've told this story before, but I'll tell you again to just add on to the story. But the second night I was there, I had a dream where I was sleeping by the creek. And I was in a sleeping bag, and I was cowboy camping. So that means you're just camping without a tent. And in the dream, I was cowboy camping. In real life, I had a tent and I was in camp. In the dream, cowboy camping, like literally right next to the creek. Like the water would have touched me if I would have rolled over. And off to the left was the bank, the rest of the bank that went up to the woods. And I saw a lone coyote come out of the woods, and I was like, oh no, here we go. And I remember it came up to me and started sniffing my feet, and then sniffing up my leg and up my body. And I was in my sleeping bag, so like I couldn't really fight back, you know, and I was getting scared. And then it bit me in my arm, and so I started trying to attack it. And I woke up screaming and punching in my sleeping bag, and I freaked everyone out. And we laughed at that for a few days. And then I think 3 or 4 days later, we were joined by more people at Laos Camp. One of them who had studied with the Yurok people and knew their traditions very well. And Laos Camp itself used to be traditional Yurok hunting grounds. And apparently in Yurok tradition, if a lone coyote appears to you in your dream or in real life, it means you're not welcome.
Wow.
And I did not know that before I came. So.
Wow.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's wild. And it bit you. It's just letting you know extra. Get out of here.
Yeah. And so you combine that with like the Bigfoot activity we had, and then the orb that was seen, all of this within like a span of like 6 days. And it's like by far one of the weirdest places I've ever been to. And it's like in the day, it's fine. In the day, I didn't feel weird, but at night it was like the whole attitude of the place changed. So
that's awesome. Thanks for sharing that.
Hey, you're welcome. Anything from my favorite podcast host on my favorite podcast.
Oh, goodness gracious. Well, before we leave, can you let everybody know where they can find you?
Yeah, I guess you can follow me on Instagram at the Eli Watson.
The Eli Watson?
The Eli Watson. Here, you want to know another story?
Yeah, sure.
Where that came from. Because I have a feeling people think I'm conceited. But it started in when I was applying to colleges at the end of high school, and I was just going to use my basic email, which I'm not going to share here because I don't want people to know it. But
right.
I like created it when I was like 12. So it was like some goofy little email.
Sure.
And my high school counselor was like, that's your email? And I was like, yeah, what's wrong with it? And I was like, you probably want something a little more professional. And I was like, okay. So then we sat down together to try to create a new email for myself. And Eli Watson, that Gmail was taken. And gotcha. So we ended up deciding on the Eli Watson. And I was like, well, that's kind of cool. And you know what? I've inspired my brother. My whole family uses the blank Watson. As the- and so it's kind of cool. Mm-hmm. It's my whole brand now.
I like it. I like it a lot. So they can follow you at the Eli Watson
on, yep. on Instagram.
On IG.
And then that's where I'm most active. I'm also there on Twitter as well. You can email me if you desire to email me. Excuse me. Please use my professional email. That's eli@smalltownmonsters.com.
Mm-hmm.
And I will try to get back to you. And that's it, I guess. Most all my stuff comes out on Small Town Monsters. Small Time Monsters.
Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you again for being here, Eli.
Hey, thank you, Heather. Thank you for having me on. I'm willing to come back whenever you want me to.
Okay. All right. So next week then?
Yep.
You just become my co-host.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's do it. Awesome. Awesome. Well, guys, thanks for listening. You know, rate and review. Squad members, thanks for watching the video. You have video of us. And that's awesome. You can email me, Heather@smalltownmonsters.com. And yeah, until next time.
Bye.
Bye.